This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So what I'd like to do is give a little bit of a kind of overview of the second foundation of mindfulness. So I'll start by putting it in context a bit. And then we'll do another meditation to sort of connect us to a little bit of the first foundation and second foundations of mindfulness. Now, four foundations of mindfulness are a set of teachings that were very specific set of teachings about how we actually establish mindfulness. So mindfulness, as you know, is a big part of, I believe that you probably know, is a big part of the Buddhist path. It's part of what we're developing in our formal sitting practice that is so very often the focus of our teachings and practice together in community and in Buddhist centers and in retreats. I like to back up a little bit by saying, especially for those of you who are new, and reminding myself often that we have a very specific focus in a Buddhist practice, which is that we are concerned with the issue of suffering. So this is very much a set of tools and investigation to undermine the conditions that bring suffering into being, so that you don't have to have so much of it. That's what we're doing here. And what has been presented to help you do that is an eight-part system called the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is made up of things like right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And this section at the end of that eight-part system on meditation, effort, concentration, and mindfulness. Right? Now, within each of these little sections of this eight-part system, there are very specific teachings. So, for example, right view has to do with a wise understanding of the laws that govern life, like causality, which could also be talked about as karma, that what we do has a result, and the result matters when we're concerned with how is suffering come about. That there's something there about, well, what we do plays a role. We have a role in bringing about a result like suffering or like a sense of ease in our lives. So that there's this right, this wise view about that. Another part of the teaching is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which contain this eight-part system, actually. So then we fast forward through all of these, each of these steps, and we get to the three teachings that are specifically about the development of insight and clarity and wisdom that's the hallmark and the goal of this practice. It is the wisdom and insight that's developed in meditation practice, in mindfulness, in the development of concentration, in with our effort, that brings about the insights of how things work so that we can stop doing the shit that brings about suffering. Okay? So, one of those steps is right mindfulness, or wise mindfulness, or the development of mindfulness. So what does that mean? Well, the Buddha is said to have collected a set of teachings, specifically instructing us where to place our attention. These are foundations of mindfulness. How do we establish mindfulness, and in what? So there's four sets of teachings. And I don't know whether the Buddha actually sat down. I believe actually the understanding is that these teachings appear throughout the suttas, and they've been sort of collected into a sort of separate system where you can understand that one thing can lead to another that leads to this sort of goal of understanding how suffering comes about and how we can liberate ourselves from it. And it begins by bringing our attention to the body. first foundation of mindfulness, first section about bringing our attention to the breath. And just this kind of very subtle, simple instruction of knowing that you're breathing in, knowing that you're breathing out, knowing the nature of that breath. It's a short breath, it's a long breath. Seeing, you know, just kind of exploring the more subtle aspects of breath. Just that practice alone can be incredibly powerful. Then we move into some considerations and reflections on the body, which I think are important to, as a side note, to establish yourself in when we get to this conversation about feeling tones, which I'll spend the rest of the talk on. But it asks us to contemplate bodily sensations, the parts of the body, its elements, to consider the impermanence through reflections on death, the decaying of a corpse even. Very much a very thorough kind of grounding ourselves in the body. That's the first foundation of mindfulness. Breath, body, its elements. This second foundation, once we're kind of rooted in this, when we're more embodied, is a very, I think, one of the most helpful and profound and important teachings, and also one of the most simple. When you look at a book like, this is actually a book about the four foundations of mindfulness. The body is a section about that long. The third foundation of the mind and the mind states is about that long. And the big list of what we talk about, the teachings of dharmas, or phenomenal experience, a big section like this. The feeling tones, just a few pages. Just a couple very simple instructions. So, very often, the word in Pali is vedana. And for some reason, and I hear teachers acknowledge this all the time, there is this habit of translating into English this word vedana as feelings, which is really tricky. Because when we talk about feelings, what do you think of? Feelings. Emotions, right? In our kind of Western sense, that word feeling is, most people assume that it means emotional experience. And that's not at all what the focus of this teaching is about. So emotional experiences are much more complex, conditioned experiences that are more, probably have find more of a home in the third and fourth foundations of mindfulness, which we won't really talk about tonight. But the teachings on the mind, objects of the mind, and a few lists of other teachings that are contained in the fourth foundations, like teachings on the hindrances in the fourth foundation, or the Four Noble Truths, for example. So what vedana actually refers to is, it refers to an aspect of our experience that arises, a word that I heard that I didn't, I had to look it up, but I like it, is a concomitant, which means that it arises as part of something else. It arises in relationship, with an inseparable relationship to something else. So what is being taught here is that a sensation or an experience can arise, and it comes as a part of it, almost like a, for some reason I have this vision of like a price tag or something. And that price tag either says that this experience is unpleasant, it's pleasant, or you're indifferent to it in some level. And that every experience that you have, every phenomenal experience, every sense perception, every thought, every emotional heart experience comes with this attached element or aspect of unpleasant, pleasant, or indifferent. Does that make sense? So quite clearly the assertion is that every experience we have has a feeling tone. So even now, in the tone of my voice, or the way that I'm carrying myself, or the sounds of the traffic, or the temperature of this room, or your physical sensations, the contact of your feet or your hands, all have a sense of either you like the experience, you feel that you find it an unpleasant experience, or that you're just sort of, there's a gray area in between and that you're just sort of indifferent. Does that make sense? Vedana arises dependent upon contact of consciousness with its object. So very frequently, I like to point out that my best understanding is that our subjective human experience only has a certain number of parts that are possible. So we are having right now, in this present moment, phenomenal experiences of the five senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, physical sensations. In Buddhism, we have a sixth sense that we talk about, which is the mind. So in the same way that the retina receives light information, sense impressions of light on the retina, the mind receives thought. And that all of these experiences are conditioned by something else. Right? So the significance of, or the place of vedana, or feeling tone, is that it arises concomitant with, I hope I'm saying that word right, this is being recorded. Concomitant. It's a big word. It's a $10 word, I'm a $5 guy. What do you want? It's dependent upon contact of consciousness with an object. I just feel that's important in, it's part of what I was hoping you might discover in the sitting that we had, that kind of commitment to not moving. Now, when we're considering that all of these instructions are held in this kind of intention to understand how suffering arises and how we might end it, this teaching on the feeling tone is really, I think, super important and central. Because what very often happens when we have a feeling tone is that it gives birth to the what kind of latent underlying motivations that become the conditional factors for suffering. And in the Buddhist world, we talk about them as greed, hatred, and delusion. You see them on the back of some of these t-shirts, you know. And maybe not anymore, but we talk about this quite a lot. And one of the against the stream mottos at a certain point was against greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? That a big part of what these teachings are trying to do is get us to undermine greed and hatred, or greed and aversion and ignorance is another way of talking about them. So greed is a sense of grasping for something that could be conditioned by a pleasant feeling tone, and trying to hold on to it or grasp onto it, even when it ends up being harmful to you, like we see in addiction issues, grasping towards pleasure despite the consequences. That there could be an intense amount of suffering around that. Grasping for pleasure is also particularly problematic in a realm where everything is impermanent. If we have a pleasurable experience and we notice that it's changing, and we have a delusional belief that we can hold on to it, then we get, as Noah often says, this sort of rope burn. That is a great suffering that arises. Now you could see the chain of events. I really like to point out the kind of causality chain of events that we can have an insight into where the creation of suffering is concerned. So for example, you could have a physical sensation that you find to have a pleasurable, a pleasant feeling tone. And then out of that pleasant, that desire to hold on and repeat that experience, arises this grasping, which in Buddhism we talk about quite clearly as the main condition for suffering. And we try to hold on to something that is going to change, because it's impermanent. The conditions for it, the experience of that thing, is changing. So that could potentially be a big cause of suffering. We see this in our relationships with people in a profound way. People change. We are operating under the delusion that other people, first of all, can't actually make us happy, and second, that they should never change. Right? Anyone can relate to the experience of trying to hold on to a person and you don't want them to change, and they're changing, and you're changing, and the conditions for you to be together are changing, and still this kind of grasping of holding on. I don't know of another place in our life where we potentially can suffer more than a situation like that. And we've all had that experience. On another level, I'm having that experience in quite a profound way around death. That this is a big edge for my personal practice. And I'm still very much, I think, laboring under a delusion that all my friends are all going to live forever, in the face of evidence that tells me otherwise. And in particular, you know, I have a friend of mine who's been HIV positive for 20 years and has been in the hospital twice and is not doing so well. And I see this kind of deep grasping of, like, I want to hold on to this person forever. I mean, on one level, there's nothing more not sane than we know that everybody has to die. But somehow, I still have this experience of wanting to cling to this person. Like, it's just a kind of delusional clinging that's a really big part of what I'm working with right now. Really fucking hard to not be attached on that level. So, pleasant feeling tone, conditioning grasping. Grasping, conditioning, suffering. You see a kind of chain. Yes?
But isn't that situation with your friend, isn't that emotional? I mean, you said that the feeling tones weren't emotional, that they were more like an essence of what was coming.
Yes, there's an emotional component, clearly. I was trying to speak more to the grasping element, grasping in the face of impermanence. What this question really speaks to, ultimately, I think, is the difference between a level of suffering in our lives that's non-negotiable. We are going to experience loss, and we're going to not get what we want, and we're going to have something that we want, and we're going to lose it, and we're going to be bound to things we don't want, and people are going to cut us off on the road and say the wrong things, and I mean, there's this level of just suffering that is inherent in our experience. The suffering that ends in this practice is what we add on top of it, out of grasping, pushing away, not seeing the truth clearly. And yeah, I mean, of course there's an emotional piece to that. But there's a resistance in me that takes the suffering to a different level. And that's what I'm trying to work with. stealing tone, unpleasant, has this sort of capacity, becomes a condition for pushing away. So if you have an experience that has an unpleasant feeling tone, could give birth to what we talk about as aversion, pushing away. I mentioned earlier that addiction or compulsive behaviors very often are rooted in that. My experience of it is that they are rooted in that very dynamic, that very window. I have a very high level of abstinence in my life around food and alcohol and drugs, and I don't drink, I don't use caffeine, I don't consume sugar, I don't eat wheat, all because there's a certain level of compulsive, addictive suffering that arises for me in my relationship to those particular things. Now, where that leaves you when you kind of cut out sort of systematically all the ways that you can be compulsive and move away from pain, then you end up in this sort of place where, well, now I have to have a relationship with this discomfort and this pain that I was moving away from all this time. And there's a kind of a profound opportunity to transform your relationship to difficulty and discomfort when you can actually make contact with it. So it's been a big part of my practice to, not puritanically, but rather systematically over the years, the commitment is to make as much direct contact with what's actually happening and not to compulsively move away from discomfort all the time. And there's a great strength that comes from that. Even just in a practice like we just did for 10 minutes, where we can develop this capacity for non-reactivity, that whether something is pleasant or it's unpleasant, that we can turn towards it, know it fully, and not be compelled into action, particularly actions that could cause suffering, or ultimately result in suffering, as a result of the presence of discomfort or pleasure. And that's a big part of the goal of this practice. The goal of the practice is to be liberated from those compulsions, that being compelled by the desire to have pleasure at any cost, the desire to avoid pain at any cost. That there's a sense of detachment. It's not a detachment like an avoidance. It's more of a objectivity. And that's what's being pointed to here, is that you can be present for anything that arises. And that you don't have to form a sense of self around it. That unpleasant physical sensations can arise. Pleasure can arise. You can sit with boredom, this third piece, this feeling tone of indifference, and that you don't have to do anything necessarily about it. Certainly don't have to harm yourself or create suffering in response to pain, in the search or grasping for pleasure. I know I have more to say. I don't know how much more.
Do you think it's true that when you push that kind of suffering away, that all you're really doing is deferring a payment of pain there?
What do you mean?
Seems like when you medicate pain away, that the pain on the other side of it, that you... the recovery process the next day is the pain plus interest, which is a bitch.
I think so. That has definitely been my experience. I had a series of traumatic things that happened to me from like 19 to 21. Violent deaths. I witnessed the death of my mother. I was disowned by my father. A number of kind of really heavy traumas in a time where I didn't know how to any skills to handle it and no real support. And what I did as a coping mechanism was drink for 13 years. And when I was done doing that, and I couldn't, the cost-benefit analysis of drinking versus, you know, the pain that it caused became skewed more towards cost and not so much benefit, I had to stop. And at the end of that process, what was waiting for me was grieving my mother's death and grieving the loss of and the disowning of my father and having to deal with the traumatic things that I witnessed. They were all waiting for me, plus a sort of sense of, for me, just kind of feeling like I was a decade behind everybody else in my emotional maturity and development. So yeah, there is something here. I lived with another teacher, and she was saying quite adamantly tonight that this is actually about maturity. There's something there about emotional maturity when you stop running from discomfort and you turn towards and you say, this is the truth of my life. This is what is actually happening. Now, on some level, I actually think getting loaded at that point in my life was the best thing that I knew how to do. I don't know what else I would have done. Thank Buddha or whatever for... Yeah, but you have to turn towards it eventually. And I remember the advice of my teacher at the time was, you know, in early sobriety, he said, "Yo, you're just gonna have to let this stuff all come kill you. You're just gonna have to go bring it on. Like you're gonna have to get in the ring with this to prove that it can't kill you. That in fact you can endure." Whatever it is. There's a window of opportunity that arises when we can perceive, meet with our consciousness, the feeling tone. There's a lot that can arise that's quite unskillful and not useful based on the conditional factor of the pleasant, unpleasant, indifferent feeling tone. And when we can, for example, see a physical sensation, turn towards it, be with it, notice unpleasant, in that knowing, in meeting that feeling tone with mindfulness, opens a window of opportunity and how we respond. We are actually in that very awareness, in that very identifying the feeling tone, we're no longer compelled in a conditioned, habitual way to the aversion that arises out of that. And then what in Buddhism is called papancha, or conceptual proliferation, how the mind gets involved and starts rationalizing, and one idea goes on top of the other, and then those thoughts and belief systems, as they harden into belief systems and become, have an influence on the body, which is, I mean, we have a difficult, afflictive thought that turns into an afflictive emotion that becomes yet more discomfort in the body, more suffering. That whole process is unnecessary. And we can just simply see a physical sensation in the body, see the feeling tone, and open up an opportunity on how we respond. If we respond at all, there's also, you can just simply, especially in meditation and retreat experiences, just be with it in non-reactivity. We can have a perceptual experience. You can see something, notice the mind's reaction, arising out of it. Perhaps out of the mind's reaction, a set of physical sensations, the feeling tones associated with those, opportunity to open up liberative window of how you respond. I think this is one of the deepest, most important practices. Can we sit a bit? Yeah, feel free to get up and just stretch for a second if you want. So again, taking a posture that you can maintain. What I'm going to ask you to do is open up your awareness to whatever physical sensations are happening in your body. That will begin with a kind of just a general investigation of what's present within your body. Noticing contact, noticing any contractions, noticing any pain, the feeling of your clothes hanging on your body, vibrational energy, the tongue in the mouth. Noticing all the physical sensations that are present. And what I'd like you to do is find the one that is most compelling. And make that the object of your full attention. In the same way that you might use the breath. So make it the object of concentration, which means that your full attention is placed on that object, that bodily sensation, the most compelling one in your experience right now. And that you allow everything else to be in the background, all other physical sensations, all sounds, thoughts, they're still going, of course. Mindfulness knows they're there. But your intention is to place your full attention on a physical sensation. See if you can get a sense of really focusing deeply on this one object. Now with this concentration, see if you can add a subtle level of investigation about what your relationship is to that object. Is this a pleasant experience? Is it painful, unpleasant? Are you indifferent to that experience? Thank you. If for some reason your mind gets pulled into another sensation or sound or thought, instructions are simply to label that thinking, hearing, sound, sensation, and bring it back to the object, return to the concentration and the contemplation of your relationship to it through the feeling tone. If your mind wanders, also add this sense of investigation about whether or not the mind is wandering because you don't want to be with this object because of its feeling tone, particularly if you're indifferent to it. Now, dissolve that object and find another physical sensation in the body and make it the object of your concentration. Allowing the first one to just be in the background with everything else. What is your relationship to this new object of concentration? Now I'm going to ask you to just let that object dissolve. For this third object, I'm going to ask you to investigate the sensations in your heart center. The heart center could be the places where we register our emotional experiences as bodily sensations. This is mostly going to be in the belly, in the chest, the area that we refer to as the heart, actually maybe even where the physical heart exists, in the throat, in the area behind the eyes. This is a different kind of physical sensation. These are potentially of an emotional origin, yet they're still manifesting in the body. Now, it's possible that there's nothing but a sense of ease in those four areas, in that heart center. If there's nothing happening for you, then you can just focus on the breath at the end of the nostril. Otherwise, see if you can hone in on one particular aspect of physical manifestation of experience of your heart right now. In the belly, in the chest, in the throat, behind the eyes. Really contemplate that object. What is it made of? Is it a contraction? Is it vibration? Is it physical pain? Is it pleasurable? Is it a joy experience, excitement, anticipation? Love? Fear? Anxiety? Underneath the concept, what is it physically made of? How do we know joy? How do we know anxiety? Now, whether you are focusing on the breath or focusing on a physical sensation in the heart center, see what it would be like to double your concentration, to really focus, investigate that experience. Really feel into it. Open to it. Know it. and then adding the investigation of what the feeling tone is. Is painful? Is pleasant? Are you indifferent to it? And now I'm going to ask you to let that dissolve. And for the last couple minutes of this sitting, please return to the first object. Again, allowing just everything else to be in the background. This is the sole object of your attention. Has this object changed? Is this object even still there? Is it relatively the same? This is a simple contemplation of impermanence, the changing nature of things. Can impermanence be verified through this returning to this object and seeing the way that perhaps it's shifted, or maybe even your relationship has shifted to it? When you're ready, let that object dissolve. Take a deep breath and let the the exercise go. When you're ready, you can come back into the room and open your eyes. We have a few minutes for any questions, any comments, reflections about your experience, about this path in general, whatever feels important, please.
Does it make a difference in this exercise with the object, with the sensation concentrated on? The reason I ask is because we'll try to focus on the camera back, and I started wondering if that was a good idea.
Why would that not be a good idea?
Because it seems to intensify as I concentrated on it. It seemed to be distracting, like it was itself, a hindrance to the meditation. And by focusing on it, it seems to be more intense.
How is it a hindrance?
Is that a hindrance? Because it's something that's distracting me from the breath, from the focus of meditation.
So the back pain was not the focus for you?
Well, once I assigned it as the focus, yeah.
Was it the first object?
It was the first object.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, sometimes in meditation in general, sometimes if something is coming up really strongly, the physical sensation or an obsessive thought or some tendency or movement of the psyche towards something, sometimes it's really skillful just to let that be the focus. It's really asking for your attention. It's okay to be flexible in the sense of, you know, moving and making that the object of your meditation and deconstructing it, seeing what that pain is composed of, what are the parts. Very often we talk about things on a conceptual level. We talk about anxiety, we talk about depression, we talk about loneliness, craving, whatever, urges. It's very helpful to do a real study on what actually those experiences are. What is anxiety? Is it, you know, a contraction? Is it sweaty palms? Is it the sort of tunnel vision that happens? Is it obsessive thought? Is it still anxiety if one of those things isn't present? Just to really see it for what it really actually is, to break it down, deconstruct it. When you deconstruct an experience, you see its parts, you may have the experience that it's not as compelling. Now, the purpose of this whole night and this practice was just to give you an opportunity to have the practice of seeing physical sensation, seeing its unpleasant or pleasant or indifferent nature, and leaving the contemplation at that. Not allowing the mind to take over, I should do something with it, but also seeing the tendency of the mind to do that. Not necessarily to shift in reaction or response to it, but just to be with it. And that there's a way that we break the chain of events that could lead to unskillful actions which lead to suffering out of aversion to pain or out of grasping to pleasure. Now, the original question, does it matter whether it was unpleasant or I don't know if it matters. It's just knowing. The objective of the contemplation is to know that your experience is exactly like this right now. And then also to see your sort of tendency to move away from it or to move towards it or whatever. Please.
That reminds me really strongly of an experience I had a couple months back. I went through a period of really intense anxiety, and the way it physically manifested itself was this jitteriness in my stomach where I felt like I was going down a roller coaster for 2 straight months, basically. And so I was well aware of that feeling being there, haunted me, and I tried focusing on it once in meditation, and it was like a nightmare. And I had to force myself to stop. I felt like, I mean, it kept getting like more and more intense, and it was just a horrible experience. So in that particular instance, I mean, I don't know if it was worth like pushing through something or not. I think maybe just deep breath might have been better for me at the time.
Two things I'll say to that. One, we have to be super gentle. There's all kinds of things that we encounter. I mean, the reason, I talk to people all the time about retreat experiences, and there's a lot of people will say, oh my God, I could never sit with myself for 2 days or for 5 days or a week. Like, it's really actually quite a profound thing that people are really afraid to be with themselves, be with what's inside, you know? But the reality is that sometimes you make contact with some stuff that's hard to be with. That's the nature of what it means to turn towards something that you maybe have been avoiding or running away from in subtle or gross ways. Nevertheless, those experiences are there. And I think that what's being, in the sense, in the way that you can be as gentle with yourself as possible, this is not about terrorizing yourself, certainly. And I have been to places like that of like, ooh, I wasn't ready to know about that. And I think what you do in that sense is a sort of sense of like, all right, you pop it in that little room with the staircase, and you shut the door, you know, but you know that it's there, and that the practice is, every once in a while, when you feel grounded, that you go over to the door and you kind of, you know, and then you go, okay. And then you get your head in there, or maybe you put your foot in there, and whatever. And eventually you turn on the light and you look out of the corner of your eye. And the idea is that you're as gentle with yourself as possible, but that you turn towards, in as much as you can work your edge with something like this, like I'm doing with death, for example, of just going towards what it is that you're avoiding, but to be super gentle with yourself. It could be a 2-year, a 10-year process of making contact with something that's really strong. So that's one thing. Definitely be gentle with yourself. This is not about pushing yourself and hurting yourself or harming or terrorizing yourself. And you have to make that call. But work the edge. The other thing is that, especially with anxiety, what I have found is true is that for me, I have a history of anxiety and panic in my life too. And one of the profound realizations that I had is that there's something about, like there's for me, anxiety and panic were two different parts. And that anxiety was a conditioned set of experiences that arose, and that there was a subtle feeling of unpleasant that I met with a profound aversion. And it was the aversion that propelled me into panic. So that you can actually see. So once I was able to be with, over time, through mindfulness, be with the kind of base level anxiety without it propelling me into panic, just this sort of sense of like, oh, welcome back, anxiety, like old friend, you know? And this sort of sense of, have a seat over there, and I'm gonna sit down with you in a minute. Just, you're welcome to be here. I know you're here. I know you're like my crazy friend who's trying to protect me. It's some fight or flight, haywired mechanism of evolutionary, but cool. Hang out over there, and I'll get with you in a minute. And just that sort of, just that sense of welcoming it, not pushing it away, of like, I even gave it a name. It was Fred, my high-strung anxiety, low base-level anxiety friend, Fred. And what I found is that when I could undermine the panic, then I could be with and gently begin to study that, and get into an investigation. Well, what are the conditions that bring about this low-level anxiety? And for me, they were in my diet and lifestyle. I was profoundly sensitive to caffeine. And I realized that when I stopped doing that, that then the base level anxiety went away. You know, and now I experience anxiety in the appropriate places. You know, and it may not be that simple for you, but there are underlying causes, and that panic might be something separate than the anxiety itself. And that's something to look at. And this kind of practice with the feeling tones and that chain of causal events that unfolds, one dependent on the other, might be profoundly helpful. And just to work with that and let me know how it goes. Mm-hmm. It's someone else.
Who are you?
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Please.
I was reading just tonight that these feelings that we have, the feelings that we have are not an absolute, they're not something that would be everybody's reaction to a given stimulus. It's our preconditioning that causes us to have this effect.
Right.
I feel sad. And the example that was used is that somebody from Alaska will look towards going to north or southern Canada as a, wow, I'm going to a warmer climate. You know, this is great. Mm-hmm. Somebody from here or from Houston would, I'm going to northern Canada, I'm going to freeze to death.
Right.
You know? And so something makes me sad, but it would make, there's no absolute to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can find what is it inside of me that makes me sad,
right,
and kind of regress on that condition,
yeah,
that I can get to the core of it and make changes.
A super important point, and your relationship to that stimulus can change in you as well. When I was 14, I heard the Smiths for the first time. I hated them. I was like totally into like Kiss and Anthrax. And a year later, they were like changing my life. You know, them and like REM. It's a silly example, but it was like there's a such thing as an acquired taste, or you're just not ready for something, and it's your own personal conditioning. And that's a super important thing to understand, that the feeling tones and your aversions and all that aren't who you are. They don't fundamentally define you. They're conditioned. They arise out of conditions that you might have nothing to do with, and not to take that personally. And that's a profoundly liberative insight to have, that this isn't me. These aversions, these feeling tones, the way that I perceive things, it's just a process. And it's all conditioned, and it's not who I am, and they are not worth building an identity around. And in fact, if you have this sort of habit of really identifying with them, building an identity around them, you will suffer. So don't suffer. Stop suffering. We have no more time, and all the time in the world. Whatever. Announcements. It's traditional for us to dedicate the merits of our gathering, and we do that as follows. May any benefit or goodness that has come out of this gathering, this community, these teachings, these practices, may they be not just for our own benefit, but also for the benefit of all beings. Everyone we cross paths with. Amen.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.